Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Today, we're going to spend some time talking about decisions. Congress spent a year mostly avoiding decisions, though they did make a few. We'll catch up with an historian to unravel the psychology of the do-nothing Congress. Millions of Americans have decisions to make when it comes to health insurance and the Affordable Care Act. And the Winter Olympics are just a few weeks away. Over in Sochi, they're making decisions on how to run the games in a very, very Russian way. But first, we turn home to Washington. With Christmas only a few days away, some people are going to find life more difficult just after the holiday. Long-term unemployment benefits expire next week for 1.3 million recipients. And with Congress already in recess, the soonest they'll be able to address this issue will be in the new year. I've been speaking with U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's a Democrat and the senior senator from Massachusetts, even though she's only been in the Senate herself for a year. As a longtime advocate for financial protections for lower and middle income Americans, she's recently put her name on a bill that would make it illegal for employers to ask job applicants for their credit scores. I asked Senator Warren about that bill, also about the state of the economy, and whether we'll see Congress address those unemployment benefits when they return in January.
Here's the key part. We didn't get the job done, and we really need to get it done. So I think this is going to be one of the first things we'll take up after the first of the year. The idea that we're going to cut off benefits for people who are long-term unemployed, people who are working to try to get back into the job market, and just say, you're out of luck. I just don't think we can do that. So we're coming back on this, and we're going to push hard on it.
Why didn't it get done before benefits were cut off? Even if you get it done in January, best case scenario, there's going to be 3 or 4 weeks of people with no check who aren't working.
Oh, I know that. But let's keep in mind, the Republicans have been united in their opposition. And so this has been a hard rock to roll uphill to try to preserve benefits for the long-term unemployed. And right now, what the big push has been on has been to get a budget deal so that they wouldn't shut down the government. But we're hoping that once we get focused exclusively on unemployment, that we can persuade some of the Republicans to come along and get us a bill to help people.
Now, on the issue of unemployment, the Federal Reserve, made a lot of news by backing off some of the stimulus. There's technical terms for it. But they're basically not doing as much anymore with their monetary policy to try to promote employment as they were before. That's the policy. Do you think it's the right time for the Fed to back off of their stimulus using monetary policy? Are they doing this at the right time?
You know, I think the Fed actually did something pretty clever, and that is they didn't come out and say, stimulus over. Instead, they came out and they said, we're going to turn the dial back just a little bit and see what happens. And I think that's sensible under the circumstances. Look, they've basically had money out there at almost zero interest rate for a long time now, and there's a real question about what impact it's having on the economy. There's no doubt they know where they want to go, and that is to keep pushing down unemployment to get the economy to recover. But they have very limited tools here.
Now, one of the issues there within the Fed, as you know, is calcification, people who haven't worked for so long that their unemployment becomes entrenched. Now, your bill speaks to part of this probably from the opposite end of the economy, which is people who are trying to get work finding themselves undermined by their own bad credit history. And what you want to do, as I understand it, is make it basically illegal for employers to take a look at that credit score when somebody's applying for a job.
You've got it exactly right. And let's start with just some basic facts about this. There have been studies out now that basically show there is no correlation between your credit history and whether or not you're good at the job. And so what this says is don't cut people out just because they have bad credit. Give people a chance to compete to try to get these jobs. We have to remember the principal reasons that people have damaged credit. Often it's either that they've had a serious medical problem or someone in the family's had a serious medical problem, that they've lost a job, or that they have had a family breakup, either a divorce or a death in the family. Those are the things that tend to damage people's credit rating because they fall behind on a bill, because they end up with more debt relative to their incomes, that they have a disruption in their income. That shouldn't keep someone out of a job. That's basically like saying, look, if you were rich when you lost your job or when you got divorced, you know, that's not going to hurt your credit rating then, those events. So you'll do just fine. But if you're somebody who works hard but doesn't have a huge savings and then something bad happens to you and that hurts your credit, it's also going to keep you from getting another job.
Now, of course, your legislation is going to be timely because after Christmas time, we're going to be hearing a lot about the employment market inequality. Of course, your Democratic colleagues will be pushing a minimum wage increase. You mentioned UI. The president has already started doing his rhetorical setup for this, and the State of the Union is coming. So I think I'm right in assuming that you want this to be part of the mix as the country, at the urging of the president, starts to talk about an agenda of economic advancement and economic equality.
You know, you've put it exactly the right way. This is really about one more way to give people who are struggling a chance to get back in the game. And it is the case now that they can be disqualified from a job for which they otherwise meet all the qualifications just because they've got bad credit. And here's the problem. It hits people who don't have a lot of savings, but it also disproportionately hits women, particularly following a divorce. It hits seniors. It hits students. It hits minorities. It hits them hard because they are more likely to end up with damaged credit after some other bad event in their lives. We can't be shutting people out of the job market based on something that bears no relationship to their ability to do the work.
You are just coming up on 1 year.
Yes.
As a senator. What is the most unexpected thing, one thing that you really just thought, wow, it's not what I thought it would be?
So for all the things that are broken around here that are pretty public and pretty obvious to see, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox to make change. So, for example, I found out that things like committee hearings are a place where you might be able to persuade the regulators to do their jobs. In other words, if you keep your eyes open and you're willing to do your homework, you might be able to find some other ways to make change.
Some footholds that people didn't know about before.
You bet.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, has it been a good year or a bad year in Washington? A bad year, of course. Congress got so little done except confrontation. But seen another way through this reporter's eyes, maybe not so bad. Showdowns and shutdowns, nuclear options and strife for a political journalist. It's certainly been a year to remember. Listen to Harry Reid.
Is the Senate working now? Can anyone say the Senate is working now? I don't think so. Today, Democrats and independents are saying enough is enough. To change the rules regarding presidential nominees will apply equally to both parties. When Republicans are in power, these changes will apply to them just as well. That, Mr. President, is simple fairness.
Harry Reid on the nuclear option. Here's John Boehner, who's also had it with his own party.
They pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of the people at one of these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me?
They weren't kidding you, Mr. Speaker, and we were led into a debt limit confrontation and a government shutdown. Well, from the shutdowns to the divisive Affordable Care Act and unemployment benefits, from a filibuster led by the right to filibuster reform championed by the left, Benghazi and Tehran, it's been a year to remember and a year to learn from, hopefully. A broken Congress and a divided nation, what a year for this political reporter and for the whole country. Well, to help us reflect a little bit on 2013, we're joined now by Gregory Downs, professor of history at the City University of New York. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. You know, I get asked all the time, Congress is such a mess. It's horrible. It's going to stay this way. My view, I want you to knock me down on this if you need to. It's going to get better when the economy gets better, when people feel like either their government's leaving them alone or they just don't have to worry about it. It might take a while, but in 2017, this will all be a terrible memory. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly an optimistic view. I mean, my vision is that we have two favorite pastimes about politics. One is we complain when Congress doesn't do anything, and then we complain when it does do things. And so that we have a tendency to be sort of like the children of divorce whenever there's any kind of conflict in politics, and to say, just please stop screaming. But conflict in politics is not bad. And in fact, I think that one of the things that happened this year is one of the most heartening developments in many years, which is the breakdown of the filibuster. I think that history shows that when Congress functions, things work better, that what really creates alienation is not conflict, but it's conflict that seems to be stifled because a majority cannot move through the things that they have been elected to do.
Now, another way to look at this is that conflict and dysfunction can sometimes breed success. A government shutdown, which is rightly seen as a major governmental failure, an 18-day shutdown. You know, a lot of people said we needed that to snap people's heads back and realize that everyone loses politically in a government shutdown. And then you got a budget deal with Paul Ryan and Patty Murray. They say without a shutdown, it never would have happened in this environment.
Well, that's, you know, that requires a level of predictive powers that a historian doesn't have. But I would say this, that I think often that we can portray, we take a lot of solace in saying that the problems are the problems of politicians rather than the problems of the people. And I do think that while there's plenty to critique the faction of the House Republicans who moved toward the shutdown, in reality that it's not clear to me that it's a failure of politicians, then it's a failure of the people, and that they were supporting a policy that was popular among the people who elected them, and that in democracy that's one of the things that's meant to that's one of the ways that it's meant to work.
People are – members of the public are getting directly at politicians on Twitter and on Facebook and screaming at them on a daily basis. It's not about going home to the district anymore. These guys are reacting to angry constituents like minute to minute.
That's right. And sometimes, it sort of bails us out. We don't have to say the people are wrong because we always say the fault is in Washington. But often the fault is not in Washington. Often the fault is in ourselves as the people. So to that degree, I think that people in Washington were scared of the response that they saw out in the countryside. People perhaps overreacted in the shutdown. And I do think that some amount of reality intruding upon a popular opinion is what's going to help move the Congress toward, congressmen, the biggest thing to me that I think to critique them on is not that they're foolish or unproductive, but they're not brave. But bravery in Congress leads to the retirement home.
Gregory Downs makes a great point. Bravery in politics sometimes gets you out of a job. And sometimes we demand, maybe in an electronic age, a little too much from politicians. A lot of it depends on what we're telling them. That's Gregory Downs, professor of history at the City University of New York, helping us unravel a very confrontational year in 2013. Gregory, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been quite a year of memorable moments, and who can forget this one?
You can keep your plan if you are satisfied with it.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
Turns out the president was dead wrong for a lot of people when he said that. We're looking back at the big scrapbook of 2013, and we want to hear from you. How has your year been? Is there a moment from 2013 that stands out for you?
My name is Caitlin, and I'm calling from Denton, Texas. My most memorable moment of 2013 was meeting my great-grandfather for the first time, who I had always been told was dead, that he died in the 1980s. And so when I found him, it was really great.
Wow, what a story, Caitlin. Well, do you have a good one? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can reach out to us on Twitter at The Takeaway. Coming up, a look at the intersections of politics, entertainment, and corporate interests as viewed through that lens of Duck Dynasty. That's in a moment, right here on The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Well, you've heard of Phil Robertson by now and his Duck Dynasty family. Usually they sound like this. Listen.
Ah, that's a poodle.
He's got killer written all over him.
They in there sound asleep. I'll get this smoke pole. I'll be their alarm clock.
Hey!
I'm starving to death.
You just ate an entire chicken. How could you be hungry?
It was a little chicken.
I'm getting a cramp. I can't see crap.
Gummit. Bingo.
Well, that's the Duck Dynasty guys having a lot of fun in their reality television world on A&E. But now, Phil Robertson is part of the political landscape. And for those of you in the dark, GQ magazine published an interview with Robertson last week in which he compared homosexuality directly with bestiality. He also stated that prior to entitlement programs, African Americans were, quote, singing and happy
i.e. nobody was complaining the way they do today. Well, the A&E network, which broadcast Duck Dynasty, suspended Robertson after the publication of that interview, and they stated this: his personal views in no way reflect those of A&E networks, who have always been strong supporters and champions of the LGBT community. The network has placed Phil under hiatus from filming indefinitely, end quote. Now, at the same time, conservative Republicans, from former Alaska governor and vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin to the current conservative Republican governor of Louisiana, that's Bobby Jindal, have weighed in and come to Phil Robertson's defense. Listen to Bobby Jindal on Fox News.
Here's where I think that it's so hypocritical of A&E and Hollywood and the left. They all say that they're for diversity, they're for tolerance, they're for minority views and opinions, unless you disagree with them. Now, I wish what A&E had said, what they could have said, was you don't have to agree with Phil, you don't have to agree with what he said or how he said it. If you don't like what he said, flip the channel.
Now, it's one thing for the governor of Louisiana to come to the defense of Phil Robertson. It's another thing when you realize that probably, most likely, most political observers think Bobby Jindal's running for president, and he's chosen this fight. Well, here with some details on the ongoing Duck Dynasty saga and some of the data behind the very obvious national divide that Duck Dynasty has exposed is Dante Chinney. He's director of the American Communities Project at American University. Hi, Dante.
Hey there.
Well, you're a numbers guy, right? We can
That's right.
Well, there have been plenty of commentary over the two Americas and sort of the divide that I mentioned, the people who find Phil Robertson's comments offensive and the people who say, right on, you have a right to say them. But you've been digging into some of the data that makes this a little more clear, haven't you?
Yeah. What we did is we work with our partners at Experian, a consumer research company, and we looked at basically who watches Duck Dynasty. So who's watched Duck Dynasty over the last 7 days is a question they ask. And there are very sharp divides. I mean, the viewership in some places is twice as high as it is in others. And the places where it tends to be highest are places that are overwhelmingly rural and tend to vote very Republican by large margins.
Okay, and you have, it looks like, lots of different sort of county types, not just two Americas, as people say, but like 15 Americas.
Yeah, and I mean, the way we view it is, you know, there are two Americas when you look at the way people vote. They either vote Democratic or Republican. But what we do with the American Communities Project is we take all these different factors, all these different kind of demographic points into account, and then we try to break down the counties that way. So we have, for instance, people who watch Duck Dynasty. It happens, the higher viewership is in aging, places we call aging farmlands, rural middle America, places we call working class country, which is heavily based in Appalachia, and places we call evangelical hubs. You know, all these places, again, very strong Republican votes. And also they tend to be 50% of the population at least, and much more in some of those places, 50% of the population is rural.
Okay, so nobody's going to be shocked to learn that people in the aging farmlands might watch Duck Dynasty more. Folks in downtown Manhattan, maybe not so much on average. But A&E knows that. They must, Dante Chinney. They know who's watching their show, and they knew when they put the guy on hiatus.
They still need advertisers on A&E, and this might be a very highly rated show, but a lot of their viewership is based in Manhattan, right? And for a whole bunch of shows, you know, they're not the Duck Dynasty network. You know, they don't want to offend people, so they've got to figure out a way to show that they take offense at these comments. But as they do that, I don't want to say they're offending, but they're putting off people in these other communities that may agree with what Phil Robertson had to say. You know, my feeling about a lot of this is it is maybe fair to say that, you know, they shouldn't suspend him for this because, look, if you want reality TV, if you really want reality TV, the reality is this is what Phil Robertson thinks. And there are a lot of people in the country who agree with some of what he had to say.
There's another reality that says that A&E Networks, which has a lot of corporate advertisers and a lot of big business that do business, not only with LGBT customers, but lots of other people, don't want the reaction and don't want the headache on just one of their shows.
That's absolutely true. I mean, and remember, this is big viewership. Duck Dynasty is big viewership, but we live in an era of, you know, 300 cable channels, you know, and as big as the audience is, the money that you're talking about, that corporate money, people not wanting to be associated with the comments that Phil Robertson made, that is a strong persuader for A&E to basically essentially, you know, punish him in some way for what he did. Yes.
And let's face it, A&E, even if individuals there don't like what Phil Robertson said, they're not interested in sponsors heading for the exits. And we've seen examples of that in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought, you know, the quote you played from Jindal was really interesting, Governor Jindal, because, you know, he says, like, if you don't like what Phil Robertson said, turn the channel, watch something else. I don't think I can recall in my life a cable network or any television network ever saying, if you don't like what we're doing, turn the channel.
So you brought up Bobby Jindal, and let's end with him. He's a politician and a smart one, is probably running for president in this current political environment. Bobby Jindal knows his market just as well as A&E knows its market. What do you think Bobby Jindal is thinking as he looks out across the two Americas or the 15 Americas and decides that this is a hill he wants to fight on?
Well, he's got two things going on for him. Number one, these are Louisiana guys, right? So he's standing up for them, I guess, as the governor of Louisiana. But the other way to look at it is these places, these aging farmlands, rural middle America, working class country, evangelical hubs. If you want to win the Republican nomination for president, you need to win these places. And I'm not saying that everybody in these places agrees with what Phil Robertson said, but a good number of them do. And he's trying to show them, I'm at least with you somewhat on this cause. Please consider me for your vote.
Well, the comments of Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty fame have exposed a lot of rifts in American culture. Corporate versus viewers, liberal versus conservative, Republican versus Democrat, maybe. Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Thanks for helping us sort of tease through the mosaic. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the year is definitely ending on a loud note for Duck Dynasty. You can decide for yourself if it's a high one or a low one. But we want to hear from you. Is there a moment that's really stood out for you in 2013?
Stephen from Astoria, Queens, New York. The Red Sox World Series, of course. Is why you really have to ask that question.
It hasn't happened at Fenway Park for 95 years. The Red Sox are world champions.
Share your 2013 stories at 8778MyTake. You can follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway. All one word, at The Takeaway. Coming up, a look at what you need to know about the Affordable Care Act on this, the final day to sign up for coverage that begins January 1st. That's in a moment. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. When the Affordable Care Act launched its signups on October 1st, users around the country were faced with a lot of glitches and eternal wait times and levels of confusion and frustration that left a lot of people downright angry. Well, in the last month, many of those glitches have been remedied, and there's been a huge uptick in signups ranging from 30 to 40%. According to the White House, 1 million new people signed up for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, in the month of December. And today, this very Monday, those numbers could be even bigger. That's because for most of the country, today is the last day you can sign up if you want insurance coverage that begins on January 1st. For more on today's deadline and other crucial Obamacare facts, we're joined by Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Mary Agnes.
Hi there.
Good to have you with us. Tell me, what's the most important thing that people need to know about today's deadline? Because there are so many deadlines when it comes to signing up for insurance. What does it mean today?
If you want coverage to start by January the 1st, you've got to sign up today to make that happen. Now, you do have until January the 10th to pay your premium. But again, if you want insurance coverage on the 1st, you've got to sign up today, whether it's through your state-based exchange or the federal exchange. And if you don't know, just go to healthcare.gov and they'll direct you to the proper exchange to sign up.
How is healthcare.gov doing now with signups? We hear that the glitches are mostly gone, but not for everybody. And a lot of people have individual questions. Overall, Mary Agnes Carey, how is the system for people who need to call in? They have special questions. They have a complicated family or tax situation. It's not always cut and dry. How's the system doing for those people?
The federal government says that they are getting back to people if they have a particular problem or if they got onto the site in October and couldn't sign up and had a difficulty, that they're getting back to them. But what we're hearing is, just as you said, if you have a special circumstance, a difficulty with your particular family situation that's out of the norm, it has been a little more difficult for you. Some people have been stuck in this identity proofing part of the process, and that where they've had to try to prove who they are, prove their identity. And for sure, people are going to have difficulties with the signups. But for those folks, getting on the 800 number, trying to iron it out that way, or going through the website and trying to make, you know, making sure they get back to you. It's difficult. But as the administration has said, in their view, the vast majority of users, that the website's working.
Now, there have been kinks and problems, not just on the user experience end, you and me getting on a website, but also on the back end, which may be even more important, even though the public doesn't really see them. And of course, I'm talking about how healthcare.gov, how the government communicates with the private insurance companies that have to run all this insurance. And I want to know, if I do sign up successfully today and the website says, okay, you have insurance starting January 1st, what are really the chances now that that's actually true? Because my insurance company has gotten my information, verified it, they're going to bill me, I'm going to pay, it's all good.
Right. As you say, this is where the federal government tells the insurance company that a particular individual has been signed up. Federal officials are saying, and I think this is very good advice, verify that with the insurance company. Even if healthcare.gov says that you are enrolled and you pay the insurance company and that's been processed, make sure you're verified through your insurer. If they may send you an email verifying it, you might be able to do it over the phone. It's an additional step, but it's an important one to verify that, yes, they have your payment, and yes, you are covered as of January the 1st.
Well, websites and signups and not having insurance all happen in real time. Sometimes it's hard to remember that a large health policy for the whole country is a years-long project, not a month-long project, and we're seeing that in action now. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A group of American citizens were evacuated from an area under dispute in South Sudan on Sunday, leading President Obama to note that he might take further action to support American citizens and U.S. interests in the contested region. Joining me now is Hannah McNeish, freelance journalist from Juba in South Sudan. Hannah, South Sudan is the youngest country in the world. Can you take a moment, please, and explain what's gone wrong there with the civil unrest that led to the need to evacuate these Americans?
Well, South Sudan was born in 2011 after decades of civil war and has been striving to carve out an identity for itself, but it's still riven by huge problems. The government is made out of former warlords, and a lot of these communities during the civil war fought against one another. There's been a bitter rivalry between the president, Salva Kiir, and his deputy, his former deputy, Riek Machar, for a while now. Kiir sacked Machar about 6 months ago, and since then people have been warning of a potential conflict. What we saw just 1 week ago was the president accusing Machar of trying to launch a coup. This seems to have unleashed a crazy amount of violence that has now gone from a political struggle to mass ethnic killings between the Dinka, the country's largest group that the president belongs to, and the Nuer, which is the ethnic group that Machar comes from. So now we are seeing rebellions across the country. We are seeing neighbors turning on one another and people fleeing the country, whether it be by being evacuated by flights, as the U.S. Embassy has done for many of its citizens and others, or just fleeing the border over to Uganda.
What do we know about the American operation? Exactly how many American citizens were evacuated? And what does President Obama mean when he says further action might be needed in South Sudan?
I think you'd probably have to ask President Obama what he means by that. Or I know that the U.S. Embassy put out a statement last night saying that it had evacuated a few hundred U.S. citizens and a few hundred citizens from other nationalities. The aircraft that were fired upon in a place called Bor in Jonglei State a couple of days ago were trying to evacuate people from there because that place has come under quite a lot of rebel fire as Nuer militia try and take over. My understanding is, and this hasn't been confirmed, is that the U.S. did not request permission to fly over or land in this area, and so the planes were shot at by rebel forces. I think that everybody, the US and other, Obama and other world leaders, are very concerned about the current situation in South Sudan. People on the ground, whether it's aid workers or just people that I'm speaking to in camps, are saying that a new civil war has already begun. And so I'm not sure what the US engagement would be, but I know it's a very big supporter of this country and played a very key role in securing its own nation in 2011.
Is there any indication, Hannah McNeish, that the UN contingent that is there in Bor and perhaps in other places around South Sudan is big enough to contain the strife that's starting there?
No, I spoke to the UN's top humanitarian chief last night, who's also deputy head of the peacekeeping mission, and he said that they only have 4,000 infantry for the whole of this country. And we saw an attack on a UN base in a very small place called Okobo last week, where two Indian peacekeepers were shot dead, another one was wounded, and about 20 civilians were massacred as 2,000 youth from a tribal militia stormed the building. Now, they're telling people, you know, come to our bases. There are over 30,000 people sheltering in UN bases. But at the same time, he admitted to me last night, you know, if there are 2,000 armed youth at the door and a few peacekeepers are to protect them, there's nothing that we can do.
Freelance journalist Hannah McNeish in Juba in South Sudan, where she describes the beginning of what might be a new civil war in South Sudan. This, of course, a day after American Osprey aircraft rescued some 15 Americans from South Sudan, at least evacuated them, aid workers and other government workers. Hannah McNeish, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Are you done with your Christmas shopping? Going to run out to the mall and do some last-minute gift buying? Well, you're going to have to decide, of course, whether you use credit card or cash or your bank card. And for a lot of people, that's a no-brainer. It doesn't make much of a difference when you're at the cash register. But it sure matters to merchants, the people selling you your gifts. Earlier this month, a federal judge ruled in a class action lawsuit that businesses can charge customers fees when using Visa or MasterCard credit cards. Not long after that, American Express reached a similar settlement, but only agreeing to it on the condition that other credit cards and other charge card users will also have the same ruling placed on them. And then the question is, what does that mean for you? Well, to get an answer to that question, hopefully we're joined by Mallory Duncan, Senior Vice President and General Counsel for the National Retail Federation. We'll also be joined in a moment by a small business owner in Brooklyn. Don Casal owns One Girl Cookies in New York. But Mallory Duncan, let me start with you. Hello.
Hi there.
Well, what does this settlement mean? Does this mean for me, the customer, when I do my last minute shopping, that if I use my Visa card, that you, the merchant, or at least the people who are part of your organization, can charge me a dollar more?
It means that on paper, but it probably won't mean that in practice for most consumers most of the time. Retailers view surcharging as a bad idea. It's not something we particularly sought. It's cumbersome. It's consumer unfriendly. And it doesn't solve the underlying problem of out-of-control swipe fees. But nevertheless, a very few small businesses may decide to do it.
Charge customers more because the banks are charging the businesses when I, the customer, use a card.
That's right. Every time a card is swiped at a merchant, there is a hidden fee that's assessed against the merchant. Now, these fees are set essentially by Visa and MasterCard, and they've been rising astronomically. They now actually exceed most merchants' net profit. So there's been a clamor to bring the fees down. Competition would be the way to do that. Instead, in this settlement, the lawyers for the card companies and lawyers for some retailers got together and agreed that they would be given the permission to charge customers. If someone were to go out and buy a big screen television and charge that on their card, the card could take 2 to 3% of the transaction. That means $20 for what is essentially a 1 or 2 second telephone call. They're astronomical fees, and unfortunately, they get rolled into the price of everything consumers buy.
Joseph Saunders, a chairman and CEO of Visa, said in a statement, "We believe settling this case is in the interest of all parties and that Visa is comfortable with the terms of the settlement."
Of course Visa is happy with this settlement. Look, you have some class action attorneys, and they will do very well. They've asked for fees of approximately $500 million. And the judge, who's probably frustrated with this big rambling case, gets it off his desk, so it's not on his docket, but he's doing that at a horrible cost to merchants and the public. And we think, ultimately, this is a very bad idea.
Thank you, Mallory Duncan.
Certainly. Thank you.
Mallory Duncan is Senior Vice President and General Counsel for the National Retail Federation. Let's hear from the little guy now, or the little gal, if I may, small business owner Don Casal. Don owns One Girl Cookies in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Don.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, you're the little guy in this situation. We heard from the big guys, from Visa and from the National Retail Federation. What does it mean for you when I use my credit card to buy cookies? Are you getting squeezed?
Oh, certainly. I think any small retailer would agree that that the fees are really they're really detrimental to business, and they make it really hard as a retailer to accept cards, and especially on small amounts for small purchases, which a lot of purchases at my store are, you know, a cup of coffee or a few cookies.
Yeah, well, let's get specific. I come in, let's say $5 on a big cookie and a cup of coffee. That's probably realistic. I use my Visa card. What does that mean for you? How much is the fee embedded in there?
It's probably up to about 4% when you have all of the different fees. And I think that's the bigger issue here, is that there are a number of different fees that are compounded. So you're really looking at about 4 or 5% on a very small purchase where there isn't a lot of profit margin already.
Does that mean then, Don Casal, that you are going to move to two-tiered pricing? I use my credit card, I get charged $5.20, and if I don't, I get charged $5?
You know, it's so hard to say, and I think my husband is my business partner, and we're really torn about this issue. As a consumer, obviously, we look at it from a consumer standpoint as well, because we are consumers, and so that doesn't make us so happy. I mean, even as a retailer, we're a small neighborhood business, and our customers aren't going to be happy about it. And so I think we just really are going to test the waters and see what the rest of the climate is like, and then make a decision based on what other retailers in the neighborhood are doing.
Are the retailers, and are you looking at your coffee shop competition down the street, I assume, to see what they're doing?
Exactly. I mean, everybody, we live we have two shops. Both of them are in commercial areas where there are a lot of other retailers. And I think we're just going to put our antenna up and see how they're handling this situation and probably follow suit, so that we're at least not the ones that are really upsetting the customers and the only ones upsetting customers. But if everyone is doing it, we'll feel maybe a little bit more comfortable taking that route.
And I've seen some signs in retailers in my neighborhood on this very issue, sometimes humorous, saying, hey, don't blame me, I'm the little guy. Visa and MasterCard mean I have to charge you more, or $15 minimum, that kind of thing. That sounds like where you might be headed.
Well, the thing about the minimum, actually, which is a great point, is we're really, you know, as per our agreement with the credit card companies, not allowed to be charging a minimum. Frankly, I would have much preferred to have seen the decision go in that direction and address the issue of minimums.
All right, Don, we got to leave it there, and I really appreciate it. That's Don Casal, the little guy in this story, owner of One Girl Cookies in Brooklyn, New York. Don, thank you.
Thank you.
As we get ready to say goodbye to 2013, we want to know what single moment stood out most for you this year. From Boston, Massachusetts, we're sent this, the striking down of DOMA. Why will it live in my memory? Because it was a huge step forward for marriage equality. Once that happened, unequal laws on the state level began falling like dominoes. I think we will look back on this moment as the pivotal one in the fight for marriage equality. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, and you can also share your story at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Putin, Pussy Riot, and other PR issues as Russia prepares for the Sochi Winter Games. That's in a moment. This is The Takeaway. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. A PR stunt That's today's defiant message from Maria Alokhina, member of the Russian punk band Pussy Riot, after she was released from a Russian prison today. Her fellow band member Nadezhda Tolokonnikova was also released today. They are the latest high-profile figures to be let out of prison as part of a wider amnesty sanctioned by President Vladimir Putin. On Friday, he let go his political nemesis, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and there, too, the general consensus seems to favor the idea that Putin needed some good press ahead of the Winter Games, an event that's been mired in a number of controversies. So there may be a lot of public relations exercise going on around the Games, but we also have to talk about an Olympic event that's going to cost the country billions of dollars and will be the focus of global attention early next year. Lucy Ash is an investigative reporter for the BBC, and she joins us. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Todd.
And with Lucy, Anastasia Uspenskaya, BBC Russian service reporter, working together on a documentary called The Putin Project. Hi, guys.
Hi.
So the Sochi Winter Games is the Putin Project, right, Lucy? Why do you call it that?
I call it that because it really is his pet project. When Russia bid for these Olympic Winter Games in Guatemala City, Vladimir Putin did something which he hardly ever does. He spoke English and he said to people, "I'm not crazy holding these games in a subtropical climate on the Black Sea. It's very exciting to be able to go swimming in the morning and then go up into the mountains and go skiing." And he sort of basically thinks that Sochi is the pearl. I mean, it was always the resort that all the Soviet elite went to. It was the sort of summer capital. It's a place that he wanted to share with the rest of the world and say, look, what a fantastic place we have here.
Yes, well, speaking of the elite, let's take a listen to your documentary now, because they have a unique way of describing the cost of the Putin Project. Listen.
To illustrate the eye-wateringly high cost of this stretch of tarmac, a Russian magazine has calculated the amount of caviar, foie gras, Hennessy cognac that could be bought with the same amount of money, and how thick this Olympic road would be if it was built from these purchased goods. So to give you an example, black caviar would be 1.1 centimetres, foie gras 1.9 centimetres, Louis Vuitton handbags all kind of torn up into pieces and stretched out on the road would be 9 centimetres in thickness.
Now, Lucy, I have to say, this might sound prejudicial, but there is something quintessentially Russian to me about describing the cost of the Winter Games, not in the length of roads that could be built or the number of people that could be fed, but in the amount of foie gras, Hennessy, and caviar that you could buy for the money that they're spending.
Yeah, well, that rather graphic description comes from Forbes magazine, Russian version, and, you know, it's very much taking the mickey, as we would say in England, out of the new Russians that are obsessed with luxury brands. But in all seriousness, these games at $51 billion, they cost 25 times more than the games in Vancouver. Now, OK, I mean, Russian officials say to us, almost all the infrastructure in Vancouver was already there. We had to build from scratch. But the question arises, well, why did you choose this place where there was very little infrastructure to hold these games? Quite apart from that, it seems that quite a lot of the state budget funds that were allocated to various projects have sort of gone missing. I spoke to one guy who is a pilot by training, but he described himself as a ski fanatic. He's actually been skiing with Vladimir Putin by helicopter, but he was one of the pioneers to bring ski lift technology to Russia.
All right, I think you're talking about Vladimir Sorokin, so let's listen.
You probably know that in Russia it's the most terrible scourge. Everything starts with and revolves around that. You can start off with a really good construction project, but sooner or later an official gets involved, and he looks at you as his meal ticket.
Anastasia Uspenskaya, you've been talking to the regular people who've been contending with the run-up to the games, and somebody named Angela. Who's Angela?
Yes, well, Angela is a lady. She lives in Sochi, and we found her via Facebook page. Somebody forwarded the link of her daughter's Facebook page with some sort of SOS message. The message said something like, people, journalists, human rights activists, please come and help us. There are bulldozers surrounding our house and taking it down while people are still inside. So we reacted to that. So when we came to Sochi, the house wasn't there anymore. So we walked with her over the rubble, and it's really heartbreaking to see there were a three stories house, beautifully built, newly built. They built it just a couple of years ago. She showed us around that here was my bathroom, here was my bedroom, and we saw some leftovers of the kids' bedroom with some wallpaper, kind of very colorful, bright wallpaper still on it.
The children were sitting in the hallway crying. I wondered how come that no one from the city hall asked the question where all these people from this house are going to spend this night. The next day I filed the complaint, and the bailiffs came around. They wouldn't even let me take my furniture out unless I bought it from them. They said, everything that is here is ours. Now, if you want to take it, you have to buy it from us.
So there is part of Angela's story, one person who got in the way of the bulldozers and what sounds like a land grab around the Sochi Olympics. Lucy, you talked to a couple of other people sort of about some of the abuses that go on. And I wanted to ask you quickly about Dmitry Kozak. Who is he?
Dmitry Kozak is the deputy prime minister. He's the man that Vladimir Putin has put in charge of these Olympic Games. So after we'd seen Angela, when I went back to Moscow, I asked the deputy prime minister, Dmitry Kozak, how this had been allowed to happen.
It's true that in the past, some people have been in too much of a hurry to build without going through the correct procedures. They've knocked down houses, got rid of backyards and gardens. We looked into such cases and punished the officials involved. This sort of thing is inevitable, you know. But that doesn't mean it's widespread. In 7 years, I have only had to deal with 10 complaints like this in a city of 400,000 people.
Well, that makes me want to close with you, Anastasia Usmanskaya. Your radio documentary is called The Putin Project. Is it fair? Is this really Vladimir Putin's individual project? I mean, how involved do you think he really has been with all of the things you found out?
You know, we have a very good kind of term in Russian language, the Potemkin village, which is from the times of Russian Tsars. Wherever the Tsar would come, the local authorities would put a nice facade on their kind of half-destroyed houses, so the Tsar gets an impression that everything is fine in certain village, in certain town, and so on. And we play with words in Russian. We're saying that Olympic village is becoming Vladimir Putin's personal Potemkin village, when the nice facade is put not for him, but when he himself puts a nice facade for the whole world. And it's really difficult to look behind this nice fence and really see what this story is all about, what the real life in Sochi is.
Vladimir Putin, president of Russia and the mayor of his Potemkin village, perhaps. Anastasia Usmanskaya, a BBC Russian service reporter, and Lucy Ash, investigative reporter for the BBC, joining us from London. They have a new radio documentary, and it is called Putin's Project. Those 2014 Winter Games are just around the corner, but we want your final thoughts on 2013. What's the one moment that stands out most for you from this past year?
Hi, this is Judith Orsetti calling from Boston. The most incredible moment for me in 2013 was watching my daughter perform beautifully in her middle school musical while my autistic son sat beside me just taking it all in. Sitting in a quiet theater is really not easy for him. My heart was full watching both of my kids shine. What a moment.
Share your story with us at 8778MyTake or at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.